where you grew up. You told me that you were born in Texarkana. Tell me a little bit about your life, what you remember about your life.
Well, I was brought up in Texarkana, Texas, and finished high school there and attended Prairie View University and received a degree in electrical engineering.
What year did you graduate, you remember?
From Prairie View. From Prairie View, 1940.
What was it like attending school in the 1940s?
Well,
30s and 40s.
30s and 40s. You know, segregation, of course, was in full force then. But Prairie View was rated as a topside school because actually it was the black unit of Texas A&M. It was tough, like any time you go to college.
What do you remember much about your high school and elementary school schooling education?
Well, my elementary school, my first year in elementary school was in the city schools of Texarkana, and the rest of my elementary school days was in Bowie County, Texas. But my high school was Dunbar High School in Texarkana, Texas, and I graduated there in 1936. But that was a marvelous, in my book, it's a marvelous school. See, we have, in fact, I'm supposed to go next month to Ophir, California. We had so many graduates from Dunbar who were successful people, and they moved to different parts of the country. And they had enough of our alumni from Dunbar in California to have a California unit.
Wow. So what do you said most of you all were successful. What do you attribute that to?
Well, to the kind of motivation that we got from our teachers. That was one of the things, now that I said that some of us are, of course, being criticized for saying that integration messed up much of our educational privileges because the black teachers were determined that we were going to learn. Mm-hmm. And 90% of them were very, very ambitious about that. And they saw to it that we did achieve. Mm-hmm. And so I think that had a lot to do with the success of the graduates from Dunbar.
What about your parents? What role did they play in that?
Well, not too much. My father was, of course, a railroad employee, and my mother was just a housewife. Like, she died when I was 11 months old. But
this is your adoptive mother or your...
My adoptive parents, so of course, bred me, but they were elderly people. And but Mama was, as I remember, was she was a cook, and Daddy was an engineer, and worked for the International Crystal Construction Company. And we lived right well. You know, we were considered middle class black folks in our community.
Now, were you middle class or were you upper class?
Well, we were really middle class. Because, as I say, Papa was engineering, and my mama was domestic, and of course I'm just a snotty-nosed kid running around the community there. But we were considered middle class folks. The upper class, of course, were the professionals, the teachers, and the lawyers, and the doctors, and those people.
So where did you live in terms of thinking about your neighborhood, the neighborhood that you grew up in? Could you tell the difference between who was middle class, who was upper class, who was poor, and how could you?
Not too much. Not in the black community, you could hardly distinguish between those people because we all lived in the same communities, you know, and we all went to the same churches and that sort of thing. So there was really very little distinction between the middle, the lower and the middle and the upper class of black folks where I came from. my little community that I was brought up in is called White Village, because it was a little village of little cottages that were built right after World War One, and the people, the black people, bought them up.
Yeah.
We had a three-room house and a lot 60 feet wide and 100 feet long, and they paid $5,000 for it.
Mm.
And back then, that was in 1917. But I still own it. As I said, we came up in a segregated community, but we didn't have any great problems with it. We had more or less, having come up in it, you accepted certain things, but there were certain things you didn't accept. So always, as I said, as a youngster, that was always the ambition within me to do something about the discrimination and segregation. And when I came out of school, the first job I could get, the only job I could get, was grocery store clerk and delivery boy.
And you came out of school with an engineering degree.
Engineering degree, that's right, with a master's degree in electrical engineering. But the only job I could get was the working for the grocery store, and that was a marvelous thing, because most of those people around there had never seen an educated black person, and they all called me Gene, my middle name, you know. But it was amazing how they accepted me. I know many other blacks around there that were really abused to a certain extent. But I worked there for Mitchell's Grocery for about 6 years, and then finally got kind of tired of the sort of abuse that I had to bear, because the little crackers would come in the place and everything. Oh, I remember once that was talking to me one day. They liked to talk to me, and the guy said, "Man, said he talks like a white man." Mm-hmm. And my English, we had tremendous English teachers, and so we were talking about something. And the guy said, "I don't do so and so." I said, "Neither do I." He looked around. He said, "Hey, Charlie," he said, "if you had to get a nigger, can't you get one that can say neither, neither?" Charlie said, "You don't you leave Gene alone now. He's educated. He came ain't to blame because you didn't go to the third grade." But anyhow, that was some of the attitudes that they had.
Now let me ask you this: How did that make you feel, though, knowing that you had an engineering degree, had a master's degree in engineering, you were working as a clerk?
I wasn't resentful at all, because I tell you, it was during the Depression years, and jobs were scarce. And the only reason I got that job was because of a white woman, when I was a kid, when I first entered high school, gave me my first job looking after 500 chickens. That's why I don't care for chickens now. We call her Miss Lily. She was a wealthy person. Her husband and president of the First National Bank in Fort Worth. But she came home to look after her parents, who were aged. And she decided she'd raise chickens to make some extra money, and gave me the job. So I had to go up early in the morning and feed the chickens and clean out the chicken house and all that sort of stuff. And that went on for a while. But Miss Lily had a lot of influence. And so she financed my college. Yeah, well, my people just weren't able. They didn't have that kind of money, because Papa died when I was about 11 years old. And Mama, the only one thing Mama was making, cooking at Nichols Motel. But that was the only thing. But we lived, and we made it. And there was no Social Security or anything in those days. But anyway, I didn't have a lot of resentment, because I knew the minds of those people there. But Miss Lily got me in a job. I was the first black that had that clerk's job like that, see. Oh, they had hired white boys. Along the way, most of the time was during vacation. But it was a very busy store, quite quite prominent and thing. But as I said, I kind of enjoyed it, ran around there, being able to upset the white folks. It was real fun. Real fun, see. But anyway, I stayed there and became very popular, as I said, with the people there. But no, I didn't have any resentment because I knew when I came out, I made application at the electric company. Mm-hmm. They had advertised in the paper that they needed apprentice engineers. And so I'd get my little papers and I walked out to the office and the Southwestern Gas Electric Company walked into the old man's office and everything. He looked up, he said, "What can I do for you, boy?" And everything. I said, "Mr. Hoffman, I see you advertise you want engineers, you need engineers, apprentice engineers, and I'm a finished engineer, I got inverted up there." He said, "You gotta be kidding." And I said, "What do you mean you gotta be kidding?" He said, "You know I can't hire them niggas as an engineer." He said, "Those boys would stick a hot wire." Mm-hmm. Boy, tears came in my eyes because I had lived there, born and raised in that situation.
Now, did you know him personally?
No, no. He's the big man here at the electric company. See, I had drank out of their separate fountains and we were ridden in the back of the bus and all that sort of business. But it never occurred to me that that segregation was going to go to jobs. And I had said, Miss Lily had said, "Gene, so you got a good education now, and then you can go a long ways." And I got it. I went back and told Miss Lily. I said, "Mr. Hoffman," she said, "I got an idea of it." So she said, "Well, Charlie needs somebody. Needs a clerk, needs a delivery boy, and I'll see him." And she did. She called Mr. Mitchell up, and he hired me with a lot of trepidation, of course. But anyway, I didn't have a lot of resentment feelings deep in it. I knew that. I said, one of these days, you know, something's going to straighten out.
Do you think that other students? I mean, what kept students going? What kept black students continuing to attend college if they knew that when you graduated you could graduate with a degree in engineering, a degree in physics, but the best that you might be able to do would be a clerk in someone's store?
Well, they didn't know that. That wasn't true completely. Mm-hmm. Because see, a lot of the kids would come out of Prairie View, go to Chicago, go to Kansas City, and I had a lot of my friends who went north. And when they got there, they found employment. But as I said, most of the kids who came out must became teachers. And of course, they always need a lot of teachers. And they were scattered all over the state in different places, teaching at elementary, high school, and that sort of thing. And some even went on to get master's degrees and taught in some of the colleges. So anyway, we were encouraged to get a college education regardless of the circumstances.
Were you ever encouraged to move away from your hometown?
No. I never gave any thought about it. I was happy. Just by paying the rent.
It's always good. Free rent.
No, I never thought about moving away. Mama was there, and after Papa died, we were there, and we owned a nice home, now a rent house, which could have brought in a little bit of something to help. But it never occurred to me to move away. Now, I took a civil service examination in 1935 and passed it. And this in 1940, I was called to Washington. And here it is, as a messenger of the Veterans Administration.
And they were aware of the degrees you had.
Oh yes, they were aware of the degrees, but the examination, I took the examination, and that was the only one that was available at that time. But they took me at $1,200 a year. I got $47.75 every first and 15th of the month in Washington. And of course, I moved up the line in time to a little bit from $1,200 to $1,320 to $1,440, and that sort of thing. And eventually, after I got in Washington, I knew I wasn't going to be lynched, shot at, or something if I protested So I did. I raised a protest. I joined the NAACP in 1942 and started protesting the discrimination in the government. You know, the federal government has some the discrimination that is insidious. It was hard to do. When I wanted to move from being a messenger to a clerk, a little grade one clerk job that became available, and I would have taken a lower pay, a cut in pay, if I had taken that job. But they had somewhere to go. You see, as a messenger, that was at the end of the line. That's as far as you can go in that grade. So anyway, when I became I started to fight to get that clerk job. The guy said, "Well, you want to take a clerk job? You want to take a $60 cut?" I said, "I'm making them, but in a couple of years, I'll be eligible for some more and everything." But when I asked the boss about the possibility, he said, "Well, I'll have to check and see what the policy of the bureau is." Mm-hmm. And I knew what that meant. Policy of the bureau. I looked around and no black clerks in the Veterans Administration at all. And so then I went to civil service, and they told me, the agency can hire whomever they please. So I looked around one day, and I was in the hall at the veterans office, and this guy came up with a ladder and some tools on it. And I said, "You're an electrician?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "You're civil service?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "I didn't know we had civil service electrician." I said, "I'm a graduate electrician." He said, "You are?" I said, "Well, go down to see Mr. Mann on the first floor." And
now, was that his name, or that's just what you called him?
Mr. Mann. Mr. Mann, yeah.
I thought that was like the name.
George Mann, yeah, go see Mr. Mann. And he's the superintendent down there, and said he's the one that I guess handled all the hiring. And we do need electricians. We were real short in the way he said of help. And when I went back, I was on my trip then. I went back to the office and I said to my boss, I said, "Look, I got to go down to the first floor for a minute." He said, "Go ahead. Your next trip is not for another hour." I said, "Okay, good." So I went down and walked in the office and everything. You know, Mr. Mann looked up, "Howdy, boy, what can I do for you?" And I said, "You know the boy thing." I said, "Mr. Mann, I said, I'm here that you're short of electricians and I'm a graduate electrician. I have a master's degree in electrical engineering." He said, "That don't make no difference." He says, "Not the policy of the United States government to hire Negroes as mechanics." Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, "I'm sorry, but this is civil service." And he said, "No, that's right." I went back to civil service and they told me, "So yeah, the agency has the right to hire whomever they please." So anyway, I put my name on the waiting list. And I said, "One of these days it's going to break up." In the meantime, President Roosevelt had given an order to the War Department. They had been short of help during World War II. And they had brought some people down from New York and for clerical work at the Pentagon. And the War Department refused to put them to work because they were black. And they protested and went, and President Roosevelt issued an order: "You hire these people, give them something to do, or else get yourself a new personnel director." And when that went through, it went all through the through the agents and everything. Well, eventually I did get a clerk's job. They gave me a grade 2 rather than giving that grade 1 where I would be working in the office downstairs. Gave me a grade 2 and then sent me off to a little mess out on the still building, still out there, Kansas Avenue and Upshur Street. And it had been an old automobile barn or something, but it was a file, they filed the x-rays of the people in service there and sent me out there. And that's where all the black clerks were. But about six.
So you were just filing x-rays? Was that your job?
Filing x-rays, yeah. So I was out there. And the head man out there was an old cracker from down in South Carolina. And he was surrounded with black folks, and he shook them all day long. And we called him, the boys named him Rebo, the rebel, you know.
Oh, I see.
And he didn't understand that either. But eventually I got promoted to a grade 3 and was put up in the front office. Up there had a desk next to his, and I had to issue out all the x-rays that they were required and keep all the records and do the bookkeeping and do keep the time and the time, you know, the people working there. And the white guy that had been at everything got called in the service and went away. But anyway, and I was next up on the line, so went in there. And he wasn't too fond of me anyway, but because I didn't talk to him, like he wanted Yasta and all that stuff. See, and but anyway, he said to me one day, the boys would say he'd sneak out peeping to see what they were doing down through the files, you know, see if anybody was blowing. And the boys had a signal, they hollered, "Snowing!" Them boys are crazy in there. So what, because hot as it is, every time I go down through that hour, it's snowing. And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, maybe you cool things down somehow." But anyway, I stayed there for, I guess, maybe about 3 years. And finally, one day, this old guy came in, electrician from civil service, from federal works, and he sat down over there and was talking to Rebo. Rebo's favorite story was how he had come up as a prison guard in South Carolina. That he had a couple of niggas tried to get away and everything, and they shot one of them. And he, that boy, we would just burn when he did that. But what really anything you could do about it, you know, except express the, you know, your displeasure at it. But this old guy came in here, a little funny looking white guy, came in and sat down over there and was talking to him and everything. He looked at me and he said, "Fella," said, "I think I know you." And I said, "Old?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Where are you from?" I said, "From Texarkana." "You worked at Charlie Mitchell's grocery store?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "What you doing here? You used to be a hell of a good electrician." And said, "I got some place for you." I said, "Well, they told me not at the office that they didn't have any place for me because it was not the policy of the government to hire Negroes as electricians." He said, "I get anybody hired that I want." So anyhow, he said, "You go down to the superintendent's office down in civil service down there, and you sign up for it down there, and I'll tell him when I get down there tomorrow that I want you on." And he did. Mm-hmm. They took me on as an electrician, so I went on. But when they got me, when I went down to get hired, the superintendent told me, "We don't have any electricians, so we got electrician helpers job." So I said, "Well, that was an advancement in pay anyway." I said, "Well, I guess that's a step towards it." I said, "But with a degree in electrical engineering, I would think that ought to qualify me." Well, he said, "No, but we just don't have the opening." So anyhow, I went and hired an electrician's helper, and finally ran to him. My boss was in the old crackle from out in Maryland out there, but he took a liking to me. Mm-hmm. And treated me better, different than he did from the other black electricians. And they resented it the worst kind of way, see. And but anyway, Jerry, I've always said, he said, "Brown," he said, I'm going to get you on up there." And so sure enough, he did. In a couple of years, there was a man there named Mr. Dawson, who had been a master electrician in Pittsburgh, and come down and he was working. And he, too, was an electrician's helper. So Dawson came to me and he said, "Mom, you know, we need to go to court. We need to publicize this." And I said, "All right." So anyway, there was a little paper in Washington called the Daily News. And it came out in the middle of the day. And most people got it because it wouldn't tell you what the number was for the day. So anyway, it was widely read. But then Dawson went to the guy and told him, "Say, we got a hot story." "Yeah, we got a hot story of discrimination on it." So they took our pictures and put them right on the front of the page and all over Washington with the paper with Dawson and me. We were fighting discrimination.
Now, were you worried? Were you worried about your picture being about your job and what it might mean?
No, I wasn't concerned. I didn't feel I didn't have sense enough to be scared. But anyway, that was something else. But the guy told me, "You're gonna get fired, man. Party ain't gonna throw you out. Party ain't gonna be here in the morning." I said, "Well, beg your pardon." Well, no kidding about it. It did have an effect, and they promoted Dawson and me to full electrician status, which was a tremendous raise in pay. And they sent him to the State Department. We were now in civil service then. Sent him to the State Department and sent me to the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And so we were. He had been NAACP active person in Pittsburgh for years. His wife, incidentally, was very kind of famous. She was president of the National Negro Opera Company. Mm-hmm. And Mary was well-known and well-liked and very efficient. But anyway, we got the job, and boy, we were shouting hallelujah. We had a party. We found a room over in the Pentagon, and Dawson came over there one afternoon, and we had a party. And the other guys were all, "Hallelujah, man, Dawson and Brown, God, maybe we'll get a chance at it." But not during the time we stayed there, did anybody else ever get it. Mm-hmm. But we said it was because they put our story in the paper and put our picture in the paper. But anyway, we both hung in there. And I eventually got another promotion and became the head man with the teams, you know, from installation in the Pentagon. And when we got to the Pentagon, the Pentagon has its own electric plant, great, big, beautiful plant down in the second floor basement down there. And it has to have an engineer on duty all the time, those things. They come on automatically. If Pepco goes out, these things start up and supply electricity for the Pentagon. So a couple of times, the guy who was, they had three men who, three shifts on and everything. And daytime shift, the guy didn't show up, and he couldn't get a hold of the other guys. And so the boss knew that I had a degree. He said, "Brian, you think you can operate those generators?" I said, "Sure. I'm going to operate them when I was training." So I went down and looked the thing over, and that kind of generator I'd never seen. So I started reading everything that I could find on it, just in case. But it was, I didn't really need to do that. The only thing the engineer had to do was to cut them off. Mm-hmm. You know, when the electricity came back on, you had to cut the generators off and set them aside, and reset the switches and everything. So I wasn't too afraid, because it was nice and in summertime and no danger much of the juice going off. So anyhow, I worked at that job. I worked at it for a whole week, and then the guy came back, was supposed to be there. I said, "Okay." So then later on, that night man couldn't make it, and the boss sent me down, told the superintendent, "Send Brown down." "All right, okay." But I went down and worked a week down there at night. And they had a nice little place down there. They had a little bed, refrigerator, a stove, and everything down there. A regular little apartment that you could, bathroom and everything. You could stay there and be comfortable. And, I've stayed down there for a whole week and took the job. Well, I guess things went well and everything. And about 6 months later, the night man died. Man, I put in my application for a job. And at that time, I was getting ready to start my own business. And I thought, if I could get this night job here, and I could work half a day, I could do. Well, I put in my application, and the old superintendent was an old guy from Georgia. And he said, the boss, he said, you know better than that. You can't give Brian that job permanently. He said, you know what the policy. And oh, Lord, here we went again. So they refused to give me that job. But it was an amazing thing. An old white boy there from Akron, Ohio, that had been in my group. And I had taught him wiring and much stuff. And he was very fond of me. And he had been going to school, too. So then they offered him a job, another high-paying job. And he said, what about Brian? He said, Brian, my boss, and Brian been teaching me everything. Oh, no, but that's all you do. That's a different thing. He quit. He just quit his job and transferred back, went back to Akron, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I got mad because they wouldn't let me have it, and I quit. Mm-hmm. 14 years of service mm-hmm. in that. So I resigned and went into business for myself.
And what kind of business did you
say? Electrical contracting, okay. Yeah, electrical contracting business. And mostly in Arlington and in Northern Virginia around here.
Was that a good move for you?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Yeah, I had a couple of good contractors I was working for. They were building the houses and apartments and that sort of thing. And I hired a couple of fellows to help me and got put office on Lee Highway and, was doing all right. And had the business of Brown Electric, and I was doing right well. And of course, winter time came, and boy, it was rough having to get up and go someplace. And I latched on to another contractor that was doing some building in Maryland. So I got a Maryland license and up around Rockville and in that area. And we worked all in that bunch. And then Alexander license was the hardest one of all to get. But while I was in this, the D.C. Government had, because also segregated, but one of the guys, the first black guy that became a commissioner or something, knew me from back in the NAACP and the other community work I'd done, and he said to me, he said, Brown, he said, you know this electric stuff, don't you? I said, yeah. He said, well, they're going to need some inspectors. And I said, yeah, well, okay. So I took the examination for electrical engineer in D.C. And the first time I took it, the passing score is 70. First time I took it, they rated me as 68. And I told him, I said, there's something wrong with this stuff because that's the stuff I've taught for years and everything. And a couple of days later, I got a telephone call. The guy said, you want that license? I said, yeah. He said, well, you can get $500 you can get it. And I said, I ain't going to bribe nobody to get a license. But I'm qualified and I know it. Anyway, so I went to my congressman, old man Brahill, which was known to be one of the worst old crackers in the world. Went to Bro Hill and told him, look, I'm one of your person, in your district and everything. And they're messing with me in D.C. He said, well, D.C.'s always messed up. And I told him what happened. And he said, well, that's all right. I'll take care of it. 2 days later, I got my license in the mail. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you know to go to Boy Hill? Was this something that you were used to doing? It was your congressman, but was this something that you were used to doing if the system didn't work the way that it was supposed to work?
Oh, sure, yeah. Because at the Veterans Administration, I went to Wright Patman. Mm-hmm. And then Wright Patman was instrumental in getting me that clerk job. Mm-hmm. And because I knew Wright Patman, he was from my hometown too. And his wife and I were very good friends. They had a radio, because you're too young to remember the old time, but they had the old Crosley radio, had the long thing and with the horn up on the top of it. And not many people had radios in those days. And it went bad. Something happened, it wouldn't play. And Miss Lillard and Miss Patman were good friends. And Miss Patman said to me, Miss Lillard said, you know what, what's called Miss Patman by name? She said, Gene is a real good mechanic. She said, he knows a little bit about everything. She said, why don't you let him work on it? And I had never worked on a radio in my life. I went over there and took a look at this thing, and boy, that was like a foreign something to me and everything, and I looked through and turned it on and checked a few things around, and I said, well, there's a lot of electricity going in the place, you see. So when I looked and turned up and found out a little fuse down in this in the end there. And when I looked at that, I said, I took the fuse out and wrapped some foil around it, put it back in there, boom, the radio came on, so I cut it off real quick. I went down, down to the hardware store and bought new fuse and came back, put it in, and her old man, she thought that was the greatest thing in the world. I had to fix that radio. Mm-hmm. She had called in the regular radio man and they wanted $100 or something, which was a lot of money in that day. But if you had a radio, it's like today, it's a luxury item, you know. So they did it. Well, she remembered me from home, and when I called him on the telephone, she answered the phone. I told her who I was and everything, so she got right, went right to him, right, said, no, I talked to him. And he was chairman of the Veterans Committee in Congress, and he made a call to the Veterans Administration and told them who he was and who I was. And a couple of days later, the boss came down and said, I promise, I got something for you. Had a paper down there, signed me on. So, yeah, no, I learned, and the guys that told me around there, went, man, that's political influence and everything, and that's against the law, you're going to get fired and all that sort of business. But I said, I'm sorry, but I'll move back to Texas in a minute. I ain't worried about getting fired. So I didn't get fired, but as I said, I came on up, and then I started my business and was doing very well. And I had an accident. I was in business about 6 years, and Brown Electric got to be a pretty good sized thing. And this is when I became president of the NAACP in Arlington. And so in working with the NAACP in Arlington, I got acquainted with Dr. Henderson, who was NAACP president in Fairfax County, and we became good friends. And my secretary was a white woman, Barbara Marx, and she was a refugee from Germany. I think, I don't know whether she was Jewish or what, but anyway, she and Doc became good friends. And we all did. We really closed it in with Fairfax and Arlington and AACP, and we worked real good. And so, as I said, the Tanner Hill business here, he was instrumental in that. I guess he's the head man. His home is still down there. I think his grandson still lives.
Tell me a little bit about your involvement in the NAACP. What did you do? What activities? And I guess from the Tenor Hill, from the Tenors and your perspective, what kinds of activities?
Well, Doc and I were determined that we were going to work together to get to desegregate the schools. Mm-hmm. Doc was, as incidentally, I was the first black inspector, mm-hmm. electrical inspector, in the District of Columbia. Anyhow, but Doc was the head of the recreation department in D.C. And, you know, they had two. They had a black section and a white section, and he was at that. And we became, as I said, after we both became officers in the NAACP, we began to see how we tied in together here. And so we did. We went to... We filed suits to equalize the schools, and that when we got the courts approved it, but we didn't get equalization. They put a little addition on the Hoffman, Boston, and Arlington that didn't amount to a bean, a hill of beans. And so Doc said to me, he said, Brown, we're going to have to do something more than that. So we got Thurgood Marshall and Attorney Robinson in Virginia here, and then this guy who lived in Maryland, but he was a congressman from Detroit, Michigan, and I don't know why. I tell you, honey, when you get 87 years old, you forget your own name. So I can't
get
remember
your
name. Yeah. And we conferred and all the ways that we need to do, and finally decided that, Thurgood decided that we're never going to have anything equal, separate. So let's go old hog and go all the way and see if we can get the schools desegregated. And so this is where it started, right here in Northern Virginia. And of course, as I said, the Tenor Hill group here was older than the Arlington bunch, and they had some very devoted people here.
So Thurgood Marshall came to this area to work along with you all as you desegregated?
In fact, the decision to change from equalization to desegregation was made at my dining room table.
Mm.
And we used to meet. They could meet down at my place, and they were very, very vicious opponents to us here. Doc and I both would exchange our versions of the telephone calls we'd get late at night. Doc, things didn't improve. Doc though, rather would be here on Maple Street. But I was in Arlington, not an isolated place, but a rather open place. But nobody ever burned a cross on my front lawn, but it didn't amount to anything.
Did you have it at the time that you were in the middle of this, when you were working towards desegregation and moving away from equalization, did you have any idea of the impact that what you were doing would make? Did you have any idea how important it was, how significant it was?
Oh, yes, indeed. I was very much aware of it. Because I said, I tell you, when I left, I quit the government. I couldn't get black people here in the Northern Virginia area to join the NAACP because of Hoover, Hoover had declared the NAACP as a what kind of organization anyway. So they were afraid they would lose their jobs. So when I quit the government and went into business for myself, I didn't have to worry about that no more. And of course, Doc retired as the head of the Recreation Department in D.C., and between the two of us, we worked together in getting, we worked to get this high school here, and what's the name of it up here? Of Merrifield. What is the name of the school? Tanner? Not Tanner, but anyway.
We won't be any help because neither one of us live around here.
Yeah, no. I helped Doc with that, with the influence down in Richmond, and made two or three trips to Richmond. And they weren't particularly the congressmen. They weren't particularly concerned that I was Arlington and he was Falls Church up here, Fairfax. So anyway, between the two of us, and Attorney Monroe, who eventually became a judge in Arlington, and between three of us, and Dr. Costner, who was a pastor here at Second Baptist Church, between the four of us, we gave him such a hard time until we were able to achieve many things. In fact, we got the theaters open, and they built a school. Why can't I think of the name of that school? Right there in Merrifield. That was the first high school, black high school in Northern Virginia. And Doc and I were concerned with that. Because all the kids in Northern Virginia had to go to Manassas. They went to Virginia Dean School there. And they bust them out of here. And those kids from as far away as Berryville and Warrington, they bust them up here, and they stayed in the dormitories, like at college in Manassas there. But we didn't see that. So Doc said, he said, as many black folks and as much taxes as we pay, we can need a high school in Fairfax County. And we already had one in Arlington, but it was, very inferior. But anyway, we worked with the National NAACP and with Thurgood Marshall and with Sue Robinson, a very prominent lawyer at that time, too. and we all worked together. As I said, the Tanner Hill group here, the Far Forest Church, the NAACP, worked very closely with the Arlington.
So how were you able to get people involved if they were afraid of Hoover labeling them as radicals, as socialists? How were you able to get them involved?
Right, but you couldn't. There were some of them that if they had a job of any importance at all, you couldn't get them. They wouldn't do it. The fear of losing a job, and of course I used to tell them, you put your job ahead of your welfare, and they would say, well, you know, J. Edgar Hoover is, he's a racist anyway, but he had declared the NAACP as
radical socialist
organization. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so a number of people in different places did lose their jobs because they were there, but we didn't lose them here. But as I said, we couldn't get the people. Arlington, of course, there's a community with, and Falls Church, with fairly well-to-do black folks. But anyway, we were never able to get them. We had an activity not too long ago, about a month ago, down at Arlington to celebrate the 1954 decision, the desegregation. Arlington was the first school in Virginia to desegregate. But anyway, we had an activity down there, and we got to talking about, you know, who supported it. And I frankly had to tell people, I said, well, look, when I was president of the NAACP, I had more white members and more supportive white people than I did black folks. Yeah, they did. And that was the truth. And what it was an advantage in many ways. And so Doc up here in the Falls Church, he had quite a few white people who supported the work. But so that even now, I think on the Tanner Hill celebration, I think there's still quite a few white people who support the Tanner Hill.
Now tell me about your daughter. How old was your daughter when you were doing this kind of work, this activist work?
Lillian was 15, and mm-hmm. she was the first plaintiff in the subpoena case to go to the Supreme Court. She eventually graduated from high school, and that made her case moot.
Okay.
So we got another little girl down the street from us, Clarissa Thompson, took her place. And when the cases went to the Supreme Court, there were three cases. There was one from Kansas, one from Iowa, and one from Arlington. Mm-hmm. And those three cases went to the Supreme Court, and that the decisions on those determined that never could be separate, mm-hmm. equal but separate. But anyway, yeah, no, little was that. When we first moved to Arlington, this was interesting too, we moved in Cherrydale, and Cherrydale was a strictly white community. In fact, people had covenants in there that they wouldn't sell their places or rent their places to black folks. But when we got this place, it was during the war, and there was almost no place to live. You couldn't rent or couldn't buy an apartment or anything. And saw this ad in the paper, fellow wanted somebody to manage the property for the poor or someplace to live. And I got in touch with him, found out he was from Texas too, and he took a liking to me. And we moved out here in Cherrydale, right down in the middle of Ku Klux Klan headquarters. Mm-hmm. But you know, nobody ever bothered us one bit. But we had a building, a nice little house there that had a garage under it, and we used the garage for storage or something. But anyway, we were the only black folks living in Cherrydale at that time. Well, when Lillian was, I guess she must have been about seven, 8 years old. At that time, she got very kind of time for her to go to school. We lived two blocks from Cherrydale School. And I spoke to the guy about it, I said, my daughter goes to school. No, indeed, you heard of segregation law. So I jumped the school board about the discrimination. The old superintendent was a tough old guy too. But now he's calling, Mr. Brown, now you know I can't do that. I'll lose my job and lose all my money too. That. So I said, I can't help that, mister. Y'all got to do something about it. And how you come to live in Cherrydale? I said, that's my business. But anyway, they sent a bus down the Randolph Street every morning to pick up Lillian. One little child in a big old bus had come up the highway to Langston School up in Halls Hill. And that one, that
and they paid for that.
They paid for that 2 years. They would do it. And they got going one while where they didn't pick up in the afternoon. And Lil would walk home. And it was that, but you know, wasn't too far away. Lil would walk home a couple of times. And I told her, I don't want you walking up Lee Highway by yourself. There's somebody looking, see little black girl. But Lee's so fair. A lot of times, living down there, a lot of people didn't protest because they thought you were white. But anyway, that was one of the things that we got into. So and I told the superintendent and the government, that's cost us a whole lot of money every time. Because I can't help that. It cost me a whole lot of money, too. But you're supposed to pay. So anyway, they did for 2 years, and Lillian finally finished to Langston School, elementary school, and then she had to go to Harvard and Boston. So then that again was a problem of getting down there. So they sent the bus up to Langston to pick up some kids to go to Harvard and Boston. And somehow or other we got hooked up to get her to Langston. But those were some tough days.
Now, would you have been, if she would have been allowed to attend the white school, would you have let her?
Oh, sure. It was Washington Lee was just about four blocks from where we were living. Yeah, she could have gone. In fact, she had loads of friends. She and the white kids on our street, Randolph Street, and back on Stafford Street. They became good friends and buddies, and they wanted to go. There was a lot of Lee and everything. I'm like, Mr. Brown, how come Lee ain't going to school? I thought she's going to school with us and everything. I said, they got some kind of law that says she can't go to the same school with you. And finally her mother explained it to her. But she couldn't understand it either, this little white girl that Lee's buddy. But anyway, we made it on through.
So what was high school like for her by the time she got to middle school and high school? What was that like?
Well, high school was still the same inferior high school, and it wasn't any middle school for us.
That's right.
Yeah, the high school was still inferior, but she finished Harvard and Boston and went on to Howard. But my son went to Washington Lee. Mm-hmm. However, he was born down in Cherrydale, but in the meantime, when the desegregation, when the Supreme Court, you know, broke it up, he was just coming out of Langston, and so he went to. We eventually bought, as I said, in a couple of years, we bought a home up in the black community, Jimmy went to Washington Lee. Graduated from Washington Lee, right along with white kids, and he's still some of his buddies. He's dead now, but some of his buddies that still get in touch with us every once in a while. And he's buried right out here, and they come up now and then about once a year and put some flowers on his grave. He was very popular. It was only two or three black kids in Hobham, Washington Lee at that time. But when we desegregated the schools, we sent the black kids to Stratford. Mm-hmm. Stratford, that was a junior high. And we had four youngsters from our community who went down and desegregated the schools.
So the parents felt comfortable sending their children to those desegregated schools? Was there ever a time when
they went with them? They went with them. They would walk down Lee Highway and then down to the drive and walked on down with them and went on to school. But see, they had policemen at the school in case any violence started. And kids went down there and it was an amazing thing. They thought there was going to be some fights and everything. Kids would go, you're here. They heard about it in the paper. The white kids welcomed them and treated them so nice. And they still can't get over it, less than the bunch they were at that activity I told you about. And they still can't get over how nice the white kids were but when they got to her.
And do you think that that was an unusual situation, or you think that perhaps that might have been the situation with a lot of students in other places that desegregated schools?
Oh, sure, after they got through with all the hate talk and that sort of business. But see, Arlington is a progressive community, and kids not in there could have been some racist white kids in Stafford, but they didn't show up because the majority of the people are well-to-do folks. So anyway, no, indeed, they didn't have any problem with it. Dorothy Ham was the leader, and she died a couple of weeks ago. But we had our community, what they was called, known as Halls Hill, is known now.
Spell that for me. Is it Halls?
Halls.
H-A-L-L.
Yes, Halls Hill. But it's now known as Highview Park. But the youngsters from there were the first ones to desegregate the Arlington schools.
Let's go back a little bit and tell me about your relationship with Mr. Tenner. How did you meet him?
We met when I became president of the NAACP in Arlington, and he was president of the NAACP in Falls Church. And because we had the regional meeting, and we met and realized we were very close together. And Doc was a very, very amenable person and a lovely person. And we became good friends. And so he said, well, since we're so close together, we need to combine our forces and do what we can. He said, you support me, I'll support you. So this is the way it went. And we did, as I said, as far as the state was concerned, we had the influence on the state organization. I don't know why I can't think of the name of the school. It's still up there.
It'll come to you as soon as we leave.
I get it as soon as you leave, every time, or halfway in the middle of the night. But it's still there. It's right there on Gallows Road, just off of Route 50. And still used. But Doc and I worked together, between the two of us, on the state organization to get that school. And that was before the desegregation order came through. And of course, when the desegregation order came through, the integration was very slow in Fairfax County, because the schools are, the black communities are more or less defined, to a large extent in Fairfax. And of course, the schools were a long ways off, but they eventually got to it. I had a grandson who finished Jim Stewart about 4 years ago, and of course, nothing serious had happened to any of it. But Doc and I were both determined. We were good NAACP persons. We attended the national organizations. I never forget. I was accustomed to flying because I used to, when I was a youngster, I used to fly a little biplane thing, and I wasn't too scared about flying. But the first jet flight I ever had was Doc and Barbara and I went to.
Who's Barbara?
Barbara Marks. This is the white woman. She was my secretary. Yeah. And we went to Detroit to the national NAACP meeting. And we got the first jet, and got in there, got in the plane, and got in the flames were coming out. I said, Doc, is it supposed to be? He laughed at me. He said, Doc, he said, you never flew a jet before? I said, no. He said, yeah, that's the way they go about it. But they had to be glad that we had a lot of fun. But he knew I was a country boy, and we did very well. As I said, established in Falls Church here, and he and his wife used to teach school down at James T. Everything. In fact, when she died, I did her funeral. And but anyway, Doc was a marvelous person, a strong youth. He was well to do. He had enough money, and he didn't have to worry about discrimination on that order. But he was determined, and he became president of the state, the NAACP State Organization. And when he did, well, then we worked very closely together for desegregation of everything. And that was about my greatest involvement with the Tenor Hill folks here, as I said, with some of the residents there, members of this church. And in fact, one of the tenors, my tenor was a deacon here at the church. And so, and we have some people here who are still loyal, very loyal to the Tenor Hill setup.
You told me that you came to this area around the 1940s.
In 1940, yeah.
What was it like? What was Tenor Hill like? Can you describe it?
I didn't come to Tenor Hill at that time. Okay. See, I didn't get to Tenor Hill until, I guess it must have been around 1950, okay, before I ever got involved up here. Then I knew it was a nice little black organization. And I tell you, some of my experiences, most of my experience here was, I used to be an agent for the Southern Aid Life Insurance Company. And most of the people, I tell you, these people now have raced their law. And because it was a black insurance company, nearly everybody in Tenor Hill had the policy. Had about 5 and 10 cent policies. And so I used to come up and collect, and then I got to know quite a few of the people here on it. But so far as being active in the action, I was limited because, as I said, Doc would engage me into some, have me to speak sometime or something, but that was about it.
So what about your social life here? What did you have a social life once you came? So when you came, you were single or were you married?
Oh, no, I was married.
Married.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was the social life like?
Well, social life was for the most pretty much the same now. They had the little local clubs, social clubs, and of course, we were invited to join most of them. And the I was trying to think of a couple of clubs in Forest Church here. Irish plant? The club is still very active. They had a couple of clubs, but the social life was, as I said, with these people were relatively well educated and intelligent folks, and so social life here consisted of, you know, we say getting acquainted and having parties and various activities like that. But I don't know why I can't think of the name of the main club here, but they had two or three social clubs, and people, depending on your status, you were part of that club action. But Forest Church and the Tenor Hill group, the black Forest Church consisted mostly of the Tenor Hill bunch, and they were very, very, very active folks in the community work, in church, and in the political arena, and most of them still are. The families are still, some of the old original families are, the descendants are still on Tenor Hill, and as I said, this church has been quite involved with the Tenor Hill activities over the years.
So tell me a little about just your everyday life when you came here, and then when you came to the area in 1940. What was just a typical day like for you? And maybe talk about things where you went shopping, if you needed food or you needed clothing. Where did you do those kinds of things?
Oh, we did that in the malls and the places, and it wasn't, those places were segregated, and there was no problem with that in those days. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we didn't. No segregation in the commercial area at all. So we shopped where everybody else shopped, and we, of course, the theaters were not open to us. Right. but we got those open to, and later. In fact, we got the theaters open before we got the schools. Dr. Henderson, Reverend Costner, and Judge Monroe, and I went to Richmond and found the owners, the two men who owned all the theaters in most of the state, and talked to them about opening up the theaters. And so the Tallheimer, which was owned the big store down there, he was, more or less what he said. Well, I know the time's coming, and we soon later going to have to give up this segregation. But the other old man was some kind of politician from Alexandria, and he said, told Reverend Carson, said, can you guarantee me that you get enough colored folks to come to our theaters to fill it up? Because the white folks won't all leave. Reverend Carson said, I ain't guarantee you nothing, but I tell you one thing, if you don't open it up to everybody, we're going to close it to everybody. And they did. And Dr. Henderson said, amen. Mm-hmm. And when we good. And they knew Dr. Henderson, they really respected him, and in some way they were afraid of him, those segregationists, because he was a powerful, good speaker, and he was, as I said, an influential man. But anyway, they finally decided, they said, well, on such and such a day in April, you get your bunches together and go to each one of the theaters up there and apply for a ticket. And we'll be there. And said, if the white folks won't know you getting out of that and everything, won't that be your fault?
Were there ever times when you all were threatened because of the things that you were doing, because of your efforts to...
Yes.
Any close calls?
No close calls, except the cross that was burned on my lawn. Doc and I used to get those 2 o'clock in the morning calls. Hey, nigga, we're going to get you. And maybe you better move away from here and all that sort of stuff.
But nobody ever really...
Nobody ever really did anything to us. And, we were just crazy enough to not be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we didn't let it worry us. But in the Noxa group, they're still up here, right up near the Seven Corners and everything. And they used to come down and moved to the black community every once in a while. And we were fortunate because the police had told us, if they don't bother you, don't bother them, just let them march. And they would. And the old guy who was the head of that, I forget his name too, but he was nervy enough to come down to the firehouse at Halls Hill. And the brother said, I got some good news for y'all. And the guy looked at him, they knew who he was, and he had on his old Nazi uniform and everything. So yeah, said, I just got appropriation, got some money enough to send a whole gang of y'all back to Africa. And the guy said, you got to be crazy, man. One of the guys who was so upset, we ain't never been to Africa, how you going to send us back to Africa? Well, we thought maybe you want to go back to your home country. And so they said, the guy told him, you better get out of here now and get going, because there's something violent is going to happen. But that was how nervy they were. And they threatened Dr. Henderson a number of times. And Dr. Henderson told me, he said, I got my shotgun loaded, so they're not going to bother me. So they didn't. We were never really personally threatened.
Now, you mentioned that when you were in Oklahoma, Texarkana, you mentioned that lynching was a real possibility. Feel like it was less of a possibility here?
Oh, yes, it was. They didn't have lynching and that sort of thing here, the physical lynching like they did down there.
Mm-hmm.
Down in Texas, down there, they 200-300 guys would come in the middle of the night, drag you out of bed if they had any kind of excuse at all. And any excuse was all right with them. I never forget when I was taking my examination to be inducted into service, and the guy, they would, after the physical exam, they would interview you. And so the guy who was at the table next to me was talking to the guy, the sergeant was asking him some questions. He said, hey, Sergeant, say, ain't them Germans white folks? He said, yeah. He said, well, you know, I'm from Mississippi, and they have been teaching me all my life it's a sin to even sass a white man. And you want me to go over there and kill some white person? If you, man, ain't no way in the world I'm going to do that. And they told me, you kill a white man, you go to hell right quick and everything. He got out of service. He was from Mississippi, and they told him it was a sin and a shame, and you could get killed if you just sassed a white man. So it would do it. But it wasn't quite that tense in Texas at that time, but you could, any little thing that involved a. In fact, right after we left there, they had lynched a fellow. A little bunch of folks had come in there from Mississippi and Louisiana to work at the plant. They had a munitions plant, the Red River Ordnance plant right in Texarkana there. And these people had been imported in from Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana and places to work. And they had set up, portable housing out there, and this old gal, white gal, had claimed to say she saw some nigga trying to peep in her window one night, and it was, you know, Saturday night too, and boy, the whole gang of them, I guess there must have been 200 of them, came up 7th Street and everything, hooping and carrying on, and they came up right at a nice restaurant right at 7th and the railroad track, and this black guy who was the cook there had stepped outside to get some fresh air and a smoke, and they looked up and saw him and grabbed him because he was the first nigga they saw. And they grabbed him and tied him on the back of a truck, dragged him through the streets, and then finally hung him up at the gin, you know, where they placed him. And when he did that and everything, an awful lot of black folks, those who were able, moved away. California had a lot of jobs open and that sort of thing.
So how old were you, about how old were you when that happened?
Well, let's see, I must have been, I'm trying to think of when that happened. I was at 1040, and that was in 1942 when that happened. So 17 from 42, 7 from 12, these were, you know. And,
so how did that make you feel? What did you think? I mean, was this something you were used to? What was the mind? What was your mindset like?
Because that was the only lynching I'd known to be in Texarkana. Mm-hmm. The only lynching there, and as I said, people were in communicating with me and everything. Would tell. In fact, one girl there, Easley girl. Called me and everything. Eugene, I know you don't want to come home now and everything, but we just had a lynching here. And she called the guy's name. I didn't know him, but they had lynched him. And come to find out, and said the old gal was lied. And nobody, she's just trying to see if the guys would protect her. But had nobody been peeping. And even if they had just peeped and wondered, well, why would you go lynch somebody? See, like that. I was threatened one time because there was we lived in a little place called White Village, and it was kind of isolated. But I worked at that store, and the man that owned the store had a niece, she was a real pretty white gal, and she was going to school, going to college, and she was living with her brother and brother-in-law and her sister up the road from where the store was. Well, anyway, she was also fooling around having an affair with an older man, white man, an old Richard man, old man, what was his name? His name was, I can't think of the people's names. But anyway, she was having an affair with him, and time came when she was almost ready to get out of school, and she wanted to cut loose on him. But he had given her all kind of money, and had even given her a car and clothing and that sort of thing on it. And so they got in an argument and everything, and he smacked her up a couple of times. And so when people got home, she was out babysitting the child, and they got home, she was crying and carrying on and everything. And some nice looking young Negro in with a gray suit, and that was, you know, strange for him to say that. Nice looking young Negro man, it was strange, he was going to try to rape me. And I put up a fight and everything, but she had a couple of scars on her. And boy, that word got out, and they had this mob got out, and they went down to my mother's house where I had been living. But we had moved away, and we were living about 15 miles out in the country. And my boss out there was a highly intelligent, well-educated man, E&M graduate and football player, and Mr. White was nice. So they came out, they went down to White Village and looking on everybody's house, went down and opened, knocked on Mama's door, and Mama said, "Gene don't live there no more. Let me see." They went in and searched the house and looked down. Well, anyway, when the next day when the word got out, you know, they were looking for me, Mr. White set the word down to them down there. "You hoochies don't come out and looking for Gene, but that's my boy." They did. He told them they didn't. They never did. And it said that the girl told them to start with because they knew I was familiar with the family. And she told them it wasn't me, but they were determined that they were going to get me. So they fooled around and ran around, and they ran up in this little area called Sunset. And the boy, Paul Faison, was on his way someways. This was early in the night, and they caught him up there and dragged him dragged him up to the jail and everything. And the old man that had been this girl heard about it, and he knew the Faisons. They lived down the street from where his garage was, caught up with the police officer. He said, "You leave that boy alone. That boy ain't done nothing to nobody." Said he ran in. "He's good. He's good, and citizen, and all the bunch of told me." He said, "You know better than that." So he vouched for the boy, and he said, "I don't tell you the truth about it. I did it." And boy, that was something. The biggest gossip in the world. They said that gal took my money, and over the last 3 or 4 years and everything on it, and they don't tell me that she didn't want me to be bothered with me no more. They let Paul go, and then they wasn't looking for me no more. But his name was Rape, mm-hmm. Mr. Rape, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, he said, "It was me. I did. I smacked her up good because she was taking my money and being going to shake me loose," he said. So anyway, that was the only time I was ever threatened. But as I came up here, but I said, when it got busy and my name started getting in the paper, the guy with segregationists would call me 2 o'clock in the morning, telephone ring, bing, and I'd answer it, of course, the one just said my wife, "Yeah," and everything, "Nigga, we're going to get you." I said, "Help yourself." Wham.
So you never took them seriously?
No, I never did. Never did. Because the police department had told me, they said, "Now, if a person threatened you, said, you get out of the way, Robin, will you? And so then let us know about it, because we know all of them." And they did. There was a couple of groups. There was the National Association for the Advancement of the White People, and also the Ku Klux Klan, and another organization for white, white supremacists. But Dr. Anderson, I said, he's here, the Tanner Hill bunch here. We welcome went everywhere we wanted to go and whenever we wanted to, and went into courts and that sort of thing on it. But we were never afraid.
So tell me about how you went from being a clerk and engineer to a pastor.
Well, that was a long, long journey. That I came to Washington. I came to Washington because I'd always been active in church at home, the youngster Sunday school and in church. But I never even thought about being a pastor. But we came to Washington, and of course the about the only thing you had to do around here was go to church or something. And so I did. I attended the church at Washington, and eventually I became superintendent of the Sunday school there. And then eventually came out to Virginia, and we joined the church down in Arlington there, and I got the call, you know, the urge and the call and that sort of thing, and then finally went in the ministry, was licensed and ordained, and then they called a fellow down for the pastor died down there, and they called another fellow for the pastor that I didn't like. So I left and came here and joined Second Baptist, and people here made me assistant pastor right away, and director of Christian education, and so for a number of years, about 4 years, and the pastor here, Reverend Carson, was a marvelous person, and he died, and they called me to be pastor. So boy, say, here I am, 35 years.
And do you still continue your efforts to make sure that people are treated fairly and equally?
Lord, yeah, this church is a life member and very good supporter, tremendous supporter, and as I said, as personal support myself. Now I'm a member of the Arlington branch, and also the Fairfax branch here. So. The guy told me, you don't have to pay too many. I said, yeah, I do, because I'm engaged in both places. Because these people, these Fairfax folks, are very, very jealous of things, particularly. So, yeah, no, indeed, I'm still very, very active in the affairs. I belong to the Arlington branch and to the Fairfax branch. And also, I'm a member of the Progressive National Baptist Convention, the Like Care Baptist Foundation Convention, and I also belong to the Southern Baptist Convention group here. But that business, I remember the pain of the segregation and that sort of thing is still, you know, within me. But I was always a spunky sort of a guy, never was afraid. Because people voice threats, but nothing ever happened. And I remember one time we were coming back, we used to go home on the train during the war, that's the only way we could go. And they had the segregated cars, you know, the Jim Crow cars. And we were going down, everything was nice. I had first class tickets, and we went on to St. Louis, in a sleeper. Got to St. Louis and get ready to go down south and everything, you had to change. But we went in a nice coach, and that was just more or less something like 12 hours or something that we went in there. But coming back, I had called to get a reservation. I wanted to get a sleeper. Everything was filled up. They didn't have anything. So anyway, we had to get back, so we got on a train in Texarkana. And those Jim Crow courts, the train people were real mean then. They had a little coach, half of it was for mail car or something, and the other was just a few seats back, and because not many black people came up from that area. But anyway, we got on the train, and when we got on the train, the conductor, they had a habit, and I think they still do that, to go in the black section and put his stuff on one bench, and then his coats and things on the other. Kill two benches. Right. That's a seat. Actually, six people could sit on, but had four people were comfortable. And he had put this stuff on that. And I got on the train, was looking around for some place, and the train was full, except for those two seats. So I said, nah, this ain't gonna do. So I went and took his stuff off of the one seat and put it over on the other seat where his clothes and things were. I told my wife and my daughter, you sit here. And my wife, you think it's all right? It's going to be all right, baby. So the old porter came up to and sat on the arm of the seat there and everything. He said, you know better than that. You can read, can't you? I said, yeah, I can read. I said, I got first class ticket. And the conductor, ought to give back everybody in the other section. And the car behind us was practically empty. Mm. You know, they had some two or three soldiers on it or something. So, I looked back there to see that. I said, he ought to put his office back there and everything. He put his office where he wants to because he's boss of this train. I said, tell you what, you better shut your mouth and go about your business. And the black guy was the only one you know, to, and this sister, big fat sister, sitting over there, honey, I don't know where you from, but I know one thing, you're getting us in a whole lot of trouble here, and everything. And I said, you ain't got nothing to do with it either. So finally, the conductor, he got all the white folks first, and came up there, and conductor got to where he said, that's my seat, and everything. I said, it was your seat. I said, my daughter and my daughter and my wife didn't have any place to sit and everything. And here you taking up two seats, two whole seats, place for four people and everything. I said, you got room enough over there and this and everything on. He said, no, I didn't do it. He said, let me see. Anybody here on a pass? So the two people were riding on the pass. He made them get up and give us the seat for that. So I allowed that. I said, well, when I get to Little Rock, something's going to happen. So when I got to Little Rock, I asked the guy, I said, how long is this train going to stay here and everything? He said, for 45 minutes. I said, goody. I jumped off and I ran inside and I got to the Missouri City office in there. And so the guy said, hey, I need to talk to somebody. And he said, what's the matter? I told him we had come up from Texarkana. We were on our way to Washington. And that this guy had taken up his way. He said, I've told them guys about that. He said, using up the seats that cat. He said, you know, he said, they don't want to go back in the white section because the white guys will steal the tickets and store the stuff and everything. I said, well, I thought that was always an accusation from black folks, but anyway. So he came out, got on the train, and when the guy had gotten off too. And when he came in, he said, have you lost your cotton picking mind? He said, what you mean? He said, these people, they got paid fast just like everybody else. And you putting them here, out here, messing them up, all crowded up in here and everything. He said, you go back there and empty that car back in the back there. So there ain't but six people in a big old car. 40-some people can sit in there. He said, you get them out and send them back to the next car because they're rooming up out there. So I went to the door and he went there. He said, you guys got to get out here. We got to move you. And everything run. The guy said, oh, Lord. Boss man, I ain't done. He said, I wish I was the boss man. But anyway, he moved all the white people out of that car and moved them back to the next car back there and then came in towards. He said, okay, then you can have this car.
And were you actually sitting in front of them once you switched cars?
Yeah, we sat down. I told Hazel and Lee, and I said, come on, y'all. And this old big sister who had just something called, she tried to push her way through. I said, lady, you better stay in your seat. Want your food right away, because we just got this place, then we gonna be comfortable. And so then the conductor stood up there like that and everything, you know, got his mouth all out and everything. I said, I mean it. And it did, because the black folks were worse than the white folks. So anyhow, we went back and we got used. You know, I don't know if you've ever ridden a train or not, but the seats were fold back and forth in that. But anyway, we went back and I got a seat for Leah, and one for Hazel, and one for me. And we all stretched out and laid down, and we stayed there until we got to St. Louis. And until we got to St. Louis, of course, then we got on the first class thing on it. But I got a letter from the from Missouri Pacific people. I got the thing, still got to someplace apologize for it and saying, because, and I finally wrote my letter back and I said, it's a shame because that thing has existed over the years, that the conductor would always go into the black section, go into the Jim Crow section, and set up his office and take up seats. And folks, we were people sitting on suitcases in the aisles and on the seats and that on the arms of the seats. So anyway, I said, I've been a fighter all my life. But anyway, nothing happened. Well, said, I didn't get locked up, didn't get thrown all away or anything, but we came for it. But anyway, in Virginia, I was amazed when I got to Virginia. Because, you know, it was amazing. When I got called to civil service to Washington, I said, hallelujah, you're getting away from here now, and I'm going to get into the civil service. And I told the civil service not supposed to be any discrimination. Funny how my heart was broken when I found out that Washington, D.C. was more segregated than some of the places we had been otherwise. But it's gradually working away. And we were talking, I told my grandson last night, he had been down to Texas, down north of Texas, to visit his stepmother down there. And he was talking about how different it was from when he was down there about 10 years ago, and he said they, everything was open and right that farm, and he didn't have any problem at all. And I told him, well, that always amazed me. And I go home, I get scared sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, you get home, and there was the five and dime, numerous five and dime home, and they had, at one time, they had a barrel painted white on one side and black on the other side, and they had two tin cups, mm-hmm. and nails hang on that and everything, you can get your water. But we never drank out of that. We never knew who was in there. But anyway, when the store caught on fire and they had damage, and they redid the store and they put in fountains, mm-hmm. and they put in two fountains, a black fountain and a white fountain right here, you know, and it's supposed to do it. And we, as kids, we always go to the white fountain.
Taste the water.
And nobody ever bothered to see. Yeah. Anyway, that was the situation in that. But when I came to Virginia and found, as I said, when I came to D.C., and found D.C. all segregated and messed up like it was. I wasn't surprised when we came to Virginia. And we came here, we had liked out here, we had traveled and visited out here and gone up to the mountains and that sort of thing. And it was kind of like home. And what you segregated bus, you go to here, you had to sit in the back of the bus and come out here. So we never bothered with coming out here. But there were, just a month before we moved out here, they did away with that sit in the back, and I was real cute. I used to catch the bus going into work in the morning, and one cold, nasty cold morning, and this old white guy came way back in the back and everything, and he said, "Hallelujah!" He said, "Free at last!" He said, "Come out!" He said, "Oh, what you guys was fussing about?" The engine was in the back, and it was warm back there. Oh, what you guys are fussing about? This is the best part of the bus. And I said, yeah, until the summertime.
That's right. And as long as you're not forced to sit back there.
That's right.
Well, Pastor Robinson, we really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today.
Yeah, well, I'm glad.
I'm sorry, I'm calling you Pastor Robinson, Pastor Brown.
Yeah.
That's my pastor at my church.
Yeah, what's your
name? Tree of Life Christian Ministries.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Oh, boy. Yes, indeed. Well, I'm glad I could do it. But actually, I'm not supposed to drive, but I did. I drove anyway. My grandson's staying with me now for a while, but he had to go to work. So I told him, I said, well, I see people, I see the lines, I see everything else. I can see the speedometer, mm-hmm. and read the speedometer, but I can't read any fine writing. Mm-hmm. I can't read newsprint. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I told him, I said, well, I'm going to drive on up to the church.
Uh-huh. So how far do you have to go to get back home?
About 2 miles.
Yeah. That's not too
not
bad.
Not too bad, no, indeed. And I've driven it so much, I should be able to drive it blindfolded. Mm-hmm. Been driving for 30-odd years, see. Mm-hmm. All righty.